Third part of the series called Pain and Love and Pain, which is David and Shaul's family. And what we're focusing on tonight is the general topic is the greatest threat. So we need to say, like, what was the worst thing, the most terrible threat that actually David posed to Shaul? That's what we're going to be focusing on. So we're going to focus on two particular incidents that occur, which are really essentially the mainstay of Perek Yud Tes in Shvu'ah. That's where we're at. Okay?
Yeah, let's put these over here. Okay.
So here we go. So what we're going to do like this. We're going to be focusing, so just game plan of tonight, and then we can like sort of reflect. Our game plan is we're going to be starting from Pasuk Yud Aleph in the Perek Yud Tes, and we're going to move towards the end of the Perek, which is and divide into two sections, because there are two natural stories which are happening over here and unfolding. So here we have it. What has happened up till now is just to sort of where we last left our heroes was David HaMelech had returned upon the. Yonatan had tried to negotiate some sort of peace between Shaul and his best friend, right? Shaul's the friend. Yonatan's the friend, he's also the son, so it's very difficult to broker this peace. But he comes back, and lo and behold, Shaul cannot contain himself. Shaul throws a spear at him, almost kills David. David runs. So right now, we're at really bad terms. That's where we left off. So now, at this point in time, now we're about to get into two completely independent episodes. What finally happens is David lets the cat out of the bag. Shaul lets the cat out of the bag. Here's what he says. So we're going to go through the psukim themselves and just get a sense of what's happening over here. Vayishlach Shaul malachim el beis David leshamroi ulhamisav haboker. That's it. Shaul is no longer playing the game of deceit. Shaul has sent his messengers and he is going to now kill David the next morning. That's it. David is now to be killed. To be guarded at night and then killed in the morning. But the good news is that David has somebody in the palace. And that is the daughter of Shaul, Michal, his wife. And she tells him, look, the outside the front door are two guards. If you're going to go out there and wait until the morning, you're a dead man. You've got to get out here. You're going to be killed. So she lowered him out the window, and ostensibly the window is in the back entrance of the house, so the guards are not able to see what's going on, and he is able to leave. Just if you focus on those words for a quick second, look how it frames it. He walked and he escaped. So you notice that it's a climatic description. He walked, he fled, and he escaped. Right. So the movement is moving fast in those verbs. Some of the Mephoshim point out, without getting into all the details, is that, you know, whenever you're in a city and you see somebody running wildly, that's usually a bad sign, right? Meaning to say that there's probably something going on. You don't want to be running wildly even if you know that there's something terrible at your heels. So she gave him enough time that he was able to stroll out of town as if everything was normal. And then the moment he got past the outer limits of the city, that's when he started running wildly. So Vayelech, he was able to stroll out regularly, greet the newspaper man and at the corner and, you know, tip his hat to the guard, and then, as he got out of the city, disappear. Vatikach Michal is a trafim. So what Michal does is she takes these trafim. Let's leave that word undefined right now because it's a very strange word. We've met it once in Tanakh before. She takes some sort of object, vatosem el hamita, and she places him in the bed. Ve'es kavira yizim shama barasha. So she takes some sort of like flask of a goat skin, and places it by his head, and she covers it with a sheet or a blanket of sorts. So in the meantime, the second set of messengers arrive at the door and say, "We have an urgent matter to do to speak to your husband with." And they say, "I'm sorry, he's sick." So he says, bring the whole bed. You know, you can't get out of bed, just bring the bed, that's it. Right? And they shake the bed, and guess what falls out? Is these trafim, these objects. And they realize that they've been fooled. So Vayomer Shaul Michal, Shaul says to Michal, Lama kachari misani, how could you trick me? I'm your dad. How could you do this to me? And you sent away my own enemy, and you sent away my enemy, and now he's escaped. Who amar alai shalcheni, lama miseich? So he said, no, he threatened me. He was going to kill me otherwise. I had no choice in this whole matter. If I didn't do this, he would have That would be in the end of it. That would be in the end of your daughter. So I did what was best, the best interest of your daughter. That's what he says. By the way, very, very smart. Very, very, the way that she's handled this is extremely smart. We're going to see that it gets even better. So let's just stop for a second over here. Questions, thoughts, observations before we move on in this section. This is our story. Okay, this is story one for tonight. So what's going on over here? Any glaring issues here?
Did she think that her father would kill her?
Oh, how scared is she? Meaning to say, how scared is she of her father? Right, so we can sort of like, you know, in the spectrum of, you know, loyalty, she's clearly more loyal to David. And he's seen that, but how scared is she? Like, let's say she were to say, you know, she would say, that's what I did, right? So what would happen, right? Mm-hmm. Would he put his foot down, right? So
if she was scared, she would have gone with him.
Yeah, why didn't she go with
him? Right, so why didn't she go? She you know, yeah, because, you know, the people who usually assist people to escape put themselves in a very dangerous situation, you know, because they're going to be left with carrying the bag. So maybe she wasn't scared enough. That's an interesting indication that maybe she wasn't that scared. Interesting,
she's not
right?
Not making any attempt to convince him that her husband might be innocent.
Oh, maybe she is. Maybe she is. That's the question. Is she trying to work on Shaul's meaning, is she just giving an excuse, or is she actually saying something? She might be saying something as well. Let's dig into the words here for a second. So a few questions I just want to deal with over here is, look, if you're the king, and you realize that you've made your decision, I'm not going to do this, you know, cloak and dagger business anymore. I've decided I'm killing my enemy, right? So what's the most obvious thing you should do?
Just go kill him.
You know, speak to your sniper team.
Don't wait.
Make sure that they take care of him, and that's it. Why are you sending guards, the mourning, the whole thing? It's full of risk, and the risk was too much of a risk. He got out. He escaped, right? I mean, you say, that was a risk he took, and he lost the gamble. So why? What's in it for him? Why is he playing this game of waiting until the morning? I mean, that's very, you know, gentlemanly and everything like that, you know. But when you worry that somebody's like, you know, your foe, kill him. That's it, right? So what is he doing over here? Strange, right? I mean, like he gave David the space. He gave Michal the space to do this ultimately by setting it up in such a way. Very strange. So the Mefarshim all deal with this, and the Mefarshim have very different ways of looking at this. So let's take a quick look at some of the Mefarshim. The Radak says a very practical point over here in source 31. Why is it 31? Because remember, I'm trying to keep the same numbering for all the sources. So we've done 6.1, 6.2, and 6.3, so we're just keeping the same numbers just to make it consistent. So here we go. He says, L'shamroi l'hamitai, so to guard him and kill him. L'shamroi sh'lo yetze min habayis, he wanted to make sure that he didn't leave the house, he was under house arrest for the night. Vayirach, that he should not flee. When I meet Tov HaBoken, to kill him in the morning. Ki lo haya memis osa halayla bifnei bitoi. Ela chashav shiviuhu elav baboker vayimisuhu. So he didn't want to kill him in front of his daughter, meaning yet that he still had that sense of mercy on his daughter. He still knew his daughter loved David, and he didn't want to make a whole scene in the house. So he kind of wanted to do it a little more, you know, a little more cleanly. So he'd be taken to the court, he'd be taken to the king's house, and just wouldn't come back. And that would be it. You know? So in whichever, like, you know, we see in Shaul there's a lot of tensions. You know, he tried to sort of hold himself in check beforehand with David, wasn't able to succeed. But now even when he wants to kill him, he doesn't want to do it in a way which hurts. Now, he has the complexity of the love and the pain, you know, meaning he knows there's love, but there's so much, he is in pain, and he needs to get rid of that pain. He needs to sort of get rid of the threat, but he doesn't want to inflict more pain. It's very complex relationships over here. And that was ultimately the greatest tool here. What's David's greatest tool? Is love. Right, I mean, to say David's greatest tool is the people who love him, Michal and Yonatan. Right, so he like, and that's what actually saved him. So that's one level. But the Malbim says it was more insidious than that. It wasn't just that he had mercy. There was something worse going on over here. Listen to this remarkable suggestion. He says in source 32, in the starting from the words of the Noah Malbim himself, Al yedei kein motzo alav alila ladunu kadin mored b'malchus al sheniftar mimenu b'loy rishusai. You know what Shaul wanted to do? He said, David HaMelech, last night you left my presence without requesting a leave of absence. Well, the reason was, right, because he threw a spear at David, right? You know, that's generally a good sign that you're not wanted in the room. So, you know, like if you want to sort of take the cues, you know, like that's probably like, you know, the top 10 list. But nonetheless, David HaMelech left. So what's he going to do? He's going to now bring him to court and he's going to say, David HaMelech, you can't leave the king's presence without requesting permission. What's he going to say? And therefore, David, you're liable as a moreb b'malchus, as a rebel to the king by that infringement of the king's permission, and you're now liable for debt. So what's he essentially doing? What? So he's setting up like really like a kangaroo court, really. It's like a court martial of sorts that's being set up over here, and that's how he's going to do it. So why is he waiting till the morning? He's not going to just assassinate him in bed, because he wants to make it look like, you know, this is going to be a formal procedure, right? So nobody's going to be able to say anything, because after all, he crossed a red line. Now, did he really cross the red line? Yeah, well, he was kind of escaping. Yes.
But what would have been Shaul's excuse or rationale for when he threw the spear to kill him?
Right, we don't know. I don't know if Shaul needs that. I mean, say like when he's caught in this terrible spiral. You know, there's only one side logic, right? I saw today an article in which Qatar had said that Israel had infringed upon the Palestinian rights by killing the terrorists in the tunnel in Israel, under Israel. Wow, that's really impressive. The terror people who are about to commit terror have rights when infringing another person's actual country. I'm saying that's what happens. Unfortunately, when you're in a spiral of that kind of logic, then yes, then you know. Oh yeah, well
he didn't have to do the kangaroo court.
No, but he wants. You're right. But what's going to be the headlines in the federal press is going to be, you know, King's courtier killed for infringing King's rights. That's all that's going to be published. That's how it's going to. So that's what the headlines are going to say. And they'll say, "Oh, Nebuch, somebody else didn't listen to the king," right? That's what he wants to get. So that's why I waited till the morning. Fascinating, right? So you can see, like this is much less, you know, merciful and thoughtful as he was doing before. This is really devious now. That's why he was waiting for the morning, and it came back to bite him. If you take a look, you drop down the very bottom of the Malbim. Another suggestion he has by the ellipses is the second last line, V'gam choshav ula yamod neged ha-shomrim v'yeh damoy barashoy. You know what he thinks? David's a smart man. David knows that you look behind you when you walk into an entrance. David is a military man. David knows when there are people outside his door. That's just how it works. He's the kind of man, you know, born with eyes in the back of his head. So what's going to happen? He's going to sense there's somebody out there. He realizes there's a problem. He's going to try to make a break for it. He's going to try to kill the gods. And Shaul's going to say, and he's going to be killed in action. Shaul's going to say, fantastic. That was all I needed, right? I needed a pretext. He killed in action. I'm sorry. He was struggling with the police. There was nothing I could do. We tried our best, but you know, he was a violent and dangerous man. So you see what Shaul's kind of setting up the situation for David to be killed, and that's why he gave him this night long house arrest, hoping that David HaMelech would try to break it. And of course, he did not succeed in that. Much more devious over here than at the beginning, than the way that the Radak looks at it. Fascinating, okay? Other question over here. So what exactly is Trafim? Where have we met Trafim elsewhere in Tanakh? Right, so the word is appeared by Rachel. That is where Rachel takes the Trafim of her father. Trafim in that context means?
Idols,
right? So that means idols. Problem is, like, you know, I'm saying, like, so she's searching around the house for, like, you know, what she can use, and, you know, she's looking through, you know, the pot closet, and she pulls out the trafim. Like, what's going on? Why exactly in David and Michal's house do they have trafim? Right, now, it makes a lot of sense, because why would she use them? I mean, like, what's the logic in using them? Right, so it means that it's clearly an image of some sort of being, some sort of probably human form. So it serves the perfect purpose, right? It's going to look like some sort of, you know, graven image, and it looks like it'll give the same silhouette on the blanket as a human being. So that makes a lot of sense.
Small. Yeah, I thought they were little.
So it depends. There are different types of trophim. So it might mean that she put a bunch together, not clear, you know, then loses that allure to it. But nonetheless, this is what the Mefarshim deal with. The Radak says, the Radak brings the Yesh Mefarshim, and he says, maybe it really means the Trafim like Rachel. And he says, Chalila, how could that be? What is David doing with Trafim in his house like that? So he makes another suggestion. Take a look in Source 34. He says, I'm going to the second line where the emboldened area is. He says, he rejects the idea that David had any form of idol worship in his house. But he says something strange. He says, Yesh Amrim Shul Kli Hanachoshes, Ha'asui ladas chelkei ha'sha'os, v'yiru bohem ha'asidos, v'mishpat ha'mazalos. So he says, maybe it's some sort of measuring instrument, where like a sort of metal measuring instrument, where one could align with, let's say, the lighting of the celestial spheres, and one could sort of tell the future from it. So it would be an instrument of, whether it be divination or astrology, that a person could use for future reference. Fascinating, right? So it's moving away from, we'll call it proper Avodah Zarah, but embedded some sort of like measuring instrument. So apparently you can't extract the fact that the Teraphim still means something about the future, but it could be these. And he says, I don't understand that, because with all due respect, that doesn't look very much human, like a human, right? I mean, to say that looks like whatever it is, like, you know, that looks like a sundial, you know what I'm saying, whatever it looks like, and that doesn't look very much like a human being that you're going to put you, that's not going to be your first choice of what you put in the bed when you're trying to disguise the fact that there's nobody there, the murder of Adaxis. And he gives a third answer, which I just is fascinating. And he quotes HaChacham Rabbeinu Avram ben Ezra, Zichro Levracha. And it's interesting because, generally speaking, we don't have the Ibn Ezra consistently on Tanakh. And in most of the Mikras Gedolos, in fact, he's not printed on the page for the little sections that we do have on him. So it's actually very useful for us to have the Radak, who's a generation or two later, pulling the Ibn Ezra in here, which is very helpful for us. And he says, because Kosav, he wrote, Ki atrafim heim al tzuras ben adam, it is in fact a human-shaped image, v'hi asuya lekabel koach elyonim, but it is not to be served, but rather it's a divining agent of sorts. V'ha'ed, and he says, she'atrafim hein ha'trafim she'samim michal b'mitzah ad she'chashvu shomrei ha'bayis she'hem David, it needs to look like a human. So what's still happening is she's still left with this uncomfort, this disquieting feeling. Like, so what are they doing? You know, like, did she borrow them from the neighbor? Like, where? What's going on? Who are their neighbors? Like, meaning, like, you know. So we have to work out. But she's diluted. The Ibn Ezra has diluted this from being a fully fledged Avodah Zarah. But there's something over here which is interesting in divination. I just, as a personal just thought, it's interesting to note that there does seem to be a divination problem in Israel at this time. And Shaul HaMelech has dealt with it. We're going to see later on, towards Shaul's end, that Shaul really wants to know the future, and he's in this dry desert. He can't access God, and he's going to find a divining agent. Now, the Tanakh is going to tell us at that point that he actually made it illegal for there to be any divining agents in the whole population, so he had to search really hard to find this lady who was able to help him, this sorceress. But what's fascinating is that that's the cultural climate. So it is fascinating that there is, you know, we see this over here. It might be sort of this irony that ultimately Shaul is going to need a divining agent, is tricked by a divining agent. Very hard to know. Still, the question remains, and I don't really have a good answer why it is that they have it in their house. But nonetheless, the Ibn Ezra has diluted it from a fully fledged Avodah Zarah. But nonetheless, whatever it was, it worked. Okay, so that's you know, sachako, bottom line, in the end of the day, it worked for the purpose it was. So coming back to Esther's point. So how is she defending her actions right now? Let's just appreciate this. Is she making an argument, or is she just trying to alleviate the pressure right now? That's our challenge. So the Rashi sort of fully squares this back in Shaul's face, and you know what Rashi says? He says, "Look, you're asking me what it is that I am why it is that I was doing this to you. But in the end of the day, let's be honest." You put me in the hands of this murderous man, right? Meaning what she's saying? She's saying, like, why are you asking the question? You know who he is. You know what he's capable of. You know how many people he's killed on the battlefield. And what, you're asking me why I didn't stand up to him? So Rashi says, she's pushing it fully back in Shaul's court. Like, what right do you have to ask that question? Which is like a very strong, you know, like, the best line of defense is offense. Right, and that's what she's doing. She's putting it back in Shaul's court. But there might be more than that. I came across a remarkable, remarkable, remarkable Al-Sheikh who says the following. Listen to what he points out. Okay, so here's what he says. He notes the following. Linguistically speaking, she should have used a different word. So here's what she says. She says, "Vatomei Michal Shaul," just to appreciate the word in Pasuk Yud Zayin, she says to Shaul, "Hu Omar Eli Shalcheni?" He said to me, "Let me out." He asked me to go. "Vlomo Amiseich?" Why should I kill you? Right? So now the word lama means like why? Right? So the way we generally sort of we'll read the sentence is if you don't let me out, why will I have to kill you? Right? That's kind of a threat. It's a, you know, like, if you don't let me out, then I will kill you. But the why is like a little bit of a strange word. It should be, let me out, or I will kill you, right? And the word for that in Hebrew is pen, right? Right. In this case, it should be shalcheini pen amiseich, lest I kill you. That's the way the Al-Sheikh says the sentence should have run. So what's really going on over here? So Michal reframes the whole situation. There's a different voice. She says like this. David says to me, he said, my husband comes over to me and he says, send me. And I said to him, this is the subtext which Michal's adding, and it's clear from these words. The subtext is she says, but my father doesn't want you to go. I can't let you go. And one second, let's actually see how he frames it, because I want to make sure I get this exactly right. Here we are. Let's look at 36. Yitochen kivna lomar ki amra loy hamtini v'loy evor etzon avi. She says, please don't leave. I don't want to let my father be betrayed. V'shuhu heishiv lo lom amiseich ki yikara nafsheich be'enai. And he says, why would I kill you? Why would I kill you? Mean to say, she says to him, kill me. I can't let this happen. I can't let you go and betray my father. And what does he say? I can't kill you. I love you. Right? And so she reframes the conversation. Who's speaking? Lama Amiseich is David responding to her subtext, which is kill me and not don't let me not betray my father. So what's she done over here? Brilliant. What she's doing. Embedded in this is, first of all, she's made herself more loyal than she really was, right? Because she says, I'll stand in front of the train, right, basically. That's what she said, instead of letting David through. So she comes out, you know, basking in glory. But now David also walks out basking in glory, because what does David say? I couldn't kill you. Meaning, even if it meant not getting caught by your father, I wouldn't kill you. So Shaul, listen to that. Listen to that. Listen to what a gentleman he is. Listen to what a good man he is, and what he wouldn't do for your daughter. So you see what she's done over here? She has subtly over here pushed Shaul to a further situation of rachmanus potentially for his son-in-law. Fascinating, just like the we'll call it the psychological and emotional, insight that she has is remarkable. Doesn't necessarily help, but it's we don't know at least how much it helps. But nonetheless, it's a very, very powerful move. Okay, and now David's out, Shaul's distraught, the search continues. Now, in those days, you can't really get so far. I'm saying, in the end of the day, let's be honest, how far can you really walk? How far can you run? As people see you, so, they track your easy paths. Well, what are you going to do? So we now meet the next stage of the game. So we move back just the text for a moment. And this is now the last part of the parak, our second and last story of the parak over here. I do want to just sort of leave it out there for a moment about this whole idea about the trafim. It is interesting how this whole thing works about those trafim. It's interesting that in both cases they're being hidden by some sort of blanket, and there's deceit going on, there's a misunderstanding about what they are, and one family member feels very betrayed by another family member around these trafim. So there seems to be something which is going on over here. And he says, why did you not tell me? And he says, why did you take this? I don't have more access right now as to why it is, because we're dealing with different people. But it's just, food for the thought. Judy, you had a thought?
Like, fear is in makes me think of
yes,
Yaakov.
Yes, correct. And then again, the other time in Tanakh where we have, the hair of the goats being used as deceit is where Yaakov was wearing the skin of Esav the skin of the goats to pretend he was Esav. And here, he has David, the other red person in Tanakh who's got the red and hairy countenance is having the goat skins being used to represent him when it's not really him. So there's a lot of interesting overlays over here. But the overlays are the starting point. The question is what's the meaning? And I haven't yet got to that point, but I'm just putting it out there as a fascinating thought. Okay, let's go into the next story, because now here is where David really enters into the thick of threat to Shaul HaMelech. And here we go. So we're going to have the most unusual meeting, the only one of its kind meeting that we're going to have in this whole book. Because you see, what's happened up till now is we've had Shmuel was a very involved Navi. He was very involved in his lifetime. He was very involved in the anointing of Shaul HaMelech. And he was very involved all the way through trying to guide Shaul and when Shaul made his mistakes, right? So we've seen him through that. The last thing he really did that we actually saw was to anoint David, and then so long. That was it. We didn't see him anymore. David HaMelech in this whole episode and Goliath and everything else, no Shaul, nothing. The whole fighting, this whole tension, no Shmuel. Shmuel's gone away. What's happening? Here's the one last incident we have where Shmuel enters into the picture again. And we're going to have to sort of see, does he put himself in the ring? meaning he knows now about the tensions that are happening. Does he put himself into the ring? Is he going to referee this fight? He knows he's anointed both kings. He knows where the future's going. He's taken away the Malchus from Shalomelech. He knows David's ascending. What does he do? This is the episode we're about to read. So let's look at the Pesukim together at the beginning, and then we're going to move forward. So here we have it. But David barach vaymalet. David, we're back in Pasuk Ches. David fled and he escaped. Vayavoy el Shmuel haramas. Vayaged lo es asher kol asher asa lo Shaul. Vayelechu Shmuel vayashu b'neyot. So they went to Ramah and they went to this place called Nayot. Okay. Vayugad lo Shaul lemor hine David b'neyot b'Ramah. And of course, you know, there's nothing which ever remains secret. So Shaul finds out that David is in the locale of Ramah and Nayot. Vayishlach Shaul malachim lakachas David vayares es likhat hanavim nibeim uShmuel amed nitzav aleihem. So the group of soldiers arrive and they see the prophets are prophesizing. Vatehi al malachei Shaul ruach elokim vayisnabu gam hema. And what happens is there's a sort of like this overflow of prophecy, and even his soldiers are now sort of swept up into this prophetic state. So he gets the message, they're not returning home, there ain't no knocks on the door, so he sends group number two. And they also get caught up in this wave of prophecy. And he sends a third group, and they too are swept up in prophecy. And he says, okay, sometimes if you don't do it yourself, it just don't get done. So he gets on his horse and he goes all the way to Ramah himself. And he gets to this great pit which is by the neighboring village called Sechu. And Vayishal Vayomar Efor Shmuel v'David. He says, where are they? Vayomer hine b'neyot b'Ramah. They're in Nayot in Ramah. Vayelech shom el Nayot b'Ramah. He goes to this area called Ramot Nayot. Vatehi olav gam ruach elokim. Gamhu ruach elokim. And he is also affected by this experience of prophecy. And sort of even as he's approaching, he's swept up into this prophetic state, to the point that Tanakh tells us, he takes off his clothes. And he also is enjoined in this party of prophesizers. And he falls down, unclothed. To the point that everybody says, wait a second, is Shaul in the prophets as well? Strange story, right? Very strange story. What is going on over here? So a lot of things that we should really, really think about over here. A lot of things to think about. We're going to get to the clothing in just a second. Okay, that's definitely the strangest part of this, but there's a lot of symbolism in what's going on over here, and we have to think about that. But before even getting there, so the problem is, like, if you were to say, like, geographically speaking, where were David and Shmuel? So where are they? What was the name of the city?
Nayot.
Really? Well, which one? Is it Ramot, or is it Ramah, or is it Nayot? Now, we know that Shmuel's locale, Shmuel's city, is Ramah. He comes from our time, right? We know that. But the Tanakh seems to be telling us it's an area called Nayot. So how does that work? Is it two places? Is it one place? Is it a... Oh, because it's Nayot in Ramah. So which means to say, so Marjorie, what do you think that means? That? Okay, so maybe it's a suburb, right? Okay, so that's what the Mefarshei HaPshat go with, the idea that the Nayot is a suburb of Ramah, or a subsection of Ramah. Okay, which is what it sounds like on a Pshat level, which is like kind of which is good. Which the only thing is, like, it's kind of like strange, because, like, you know, we don't say that, you know, like every time that David arrives in, you know, in Efrat, that he goes to, you know, such and such a neighborhood, right? So it's you know, a little bit extra. But then I said, Mefarash Shabshak, go in that direction, so maybe it's a subsection. That's what the Radak suggests. Then, what was special about this Nayot place? This, like, you know, what was going on over here? So Radak says, well, you know what it is, as we're about to see, this is where Shmuel had his academy. Now, we're not used to this idea, but the way it used to work wasn't that suddenly, you know, you became a Navi. One day you're walking down the street and God says, you know, John, Susan, I want to speak to you. That's not how it works, right? The way it works is that a person would spend their entire life self-perfecting, cleaning themselves out so that they could be a receptacle for God's communion. And some people would succeed. Some people spend their entire life working on themselves to, we'll call it, clear the filter, and God decided, not really. Right? So, I mean, it was a very hard process, and they went to these schools, which Shmuel HaNavi had set up across the country. They were called the Academies of the Bnei HaNavim, the Children of the Navim, literally means to say the students. This was the prime academy over here in Nayot. So this is what was happening, which is why this whole episode is happening, that apparently there was this communion of God which occurred right then at the moment that the gods are coming in, and you know, there was sort of the electricity was connected, and everybody was part of that. and so appreciate this. Just one extra just detail that we're told, you know, like the Rambam talks about this and the Ramchal talk about this, is that when a person gets prophecy, it wasn't that Hashem, you know, speaking to a person and, you know, told them the future. That's not what prophecy was. Prophecy was that a person had a perspective into another world. A person had a vision or experience of the divine. And part of that experience may also allow them into seeing the future. And there might be a message as well which God is conveying. But that is subsidiary to the experience. Right? To the experience of the divine, where like sort of one's five senses are opened enough that one is not limited by them. That's really what's going on if a person works hard. So that's what seems to be happening right at this moment as Shaul's soldiers keep flowing in. So, and this place, the Targum Yonatan says, as quoted by the Radak, is the prime academy in which Shmuel presided, and that's why it was that this episode occurred right now. But Chazal say one other thing, and we have to think about this very carefully. Chazal say, if we take a look in the sources, this is to be found in the Radak, in source 37, the Radak says from the second last line, where the embolded section is, he says, Rabboseinu Zal Amru, so he quotes Chazal, those are the sages of the Mishnah, who says, Ma'inyan Nayot Eitzel Ramah, what are these two places? He says, Elo Shayu Yoshvim Baramah, they were in the physical location called Ramah, Va'oskim B'Nayot Shel Olam. What's Nayot? Nayot comes from the word Naveh, which means a place, and they were discussing the Nayot Shel Olam, the place of the world. What's the place of the world? That means? So what were they discussing? Shmuel was imparting to David the place of the world. In fact, the way it's understood Kabbalistically is that there's three parameters of this world, right? There's time and place, so there's the space-time continuum, right? So there's time and place, and then there's the soul. The soul sort of is ultimately the cohesion of those two planes. Now, the way it's understood Kabbalistically is that the Beis Hamikdash, or the Evan Shasia, is it's hard to use words for this. It's the place. It's not the place. It is where place emanates from. If you know what I'm saying, that's where space was extracted from. If that's what they say it. Meaning, so when it talks about Nayar Shel Olam, the place of the world, it means the place where place came from, where space was allowed to be extracted from, whatever that means metaphysically. So that's what Shmuel was imparting to him in this place, and that's why it was Ramah is the locale. Nayot is the discussion of the topic at this place, according to the Chazal. And this is highly significant for a number of reasons. The reason why this is very, very important to realize is take a look at source 41 for a second. This is the Rambam in Hilchos Melachim. The Rambam is telling us the most important communal mitzvahs, the most communal institutions that we can have. So he starts off, this is his introduction to the laws of kings. He says, Shlosha mitzvot nitzavu Yisrael b'shas k'nisas aman aretz. There are three primary commands that we need to achieve as a nation when entering the land of Israel. Limanos lahem melech, to establish a king. Shenem arsom tesim alecha melech. Okay, ulahachris zaro shal amalek, and to destroy the seed of Amalek, quoting the pasuk. And finally, livnos beis habechira, and to create the house of God. Think about this for a second. What's happened up to now? We have a king. We've attempted to destroy most of Amalek, right? What's missing? What's missing is the Beis HaMikdash. Who is Shmuel talking to? David, not Shaul. What's going on over here? You see, this is the shift of power has happened right now, if we think about this. What Chazal are saying essentially is, this is the ultimate expression of Shaul's rejection. He's no longer that vehicle. He's no longer that vehicle. Think how terrifying that is, for a second. And when Shaul is now seeing this, that's the final nail in that coffin of his realization that he ain't part of the picture anymore. That's what's happening over here. The greatest threat to Shaul is not that he wasn't chosen by the people, but that he wasn't chosen by
God.
That's what's happening over here. That third piece of the puzzle is not being given to him, it's being given to his successor. A very painful experience that is that's happening over here. So has Shmuel essentially, you know, argued with either of them who's right? The answer is he hasn't really verbally said it, but he has pedagogically, he has really essentially given it to him by teaching him this particular detail of his life. This sort of sets up David for the end of Shmuel Beis, which is when he buys the area of the Beis HaMikdash because of this moment in which he was accessing it. Just a few other important things. So kind of, we don't have so much time, so I want to just do one focus here. One is the following. This clothes business. So what is he doing? Is this how people prophesize? I'm saying like, you know, is this what happens when people receive prophecy? So Rashi says, don't get so excited. Rashi says in source 39. Rashi says, "Vayishot gamhu ebegadav." He took off his clothes. Big day malchus ilbosh big day hatalmidim. What happened? He took off his royal garments. You can say here's Shaul in his purple robes, right? His crown. What happens is he is now naked of his big day malchus. What's happened is there's been this transition in the state of prophecy where he no longer is Shaul HaMelech, he's Shaul HaTalmid once again.
And
what was that? Gam. So the gam is meaning to say as a relationship to everybody else as well. Meaning everybody else has also taken off all their heirs, whatever their heirs may be. We're going to get to that in a second. I want just to deepen that. So you've got a very good point. But Shaul HaMelech has sort of taken off his title, taken off his garb. This is like sort of the great equalizer ultimately. But No, not so simple. It may be even more than that. The Radak says, no, this is actually how it worked. So listen to what the Radak says. Now again, this is very fascinating. The Radak is in source 40. Vayishro gam hu begadov melamed shanavim ha'acherim pashtu bigdeyim. Ki gam hu l'rabos. So like your points, that the Radak says, no. He would take off his clothes. I don't know to what degree. But he says, v'inyan ze, bevo ha'nevuah ala adam yisbatlu hargashasov vayipol ha'adam. So we know that as described by the Rambam, when a person would receive, you know, a divine interaction, it would be so self-negating. There would be so little left of self, which is why they spent their whole lives preparing for that moment of lack of self. So it would be so self-negating, they would actually like have almost like a fit and fall to the floor because they couldn't, the earthly body couldn't hold the divine, which is too cerebral and powerful for such a dirty and lowly tool. Says by Bilam, he would collapse. Daniel talks about he falls into sleep when he receives God. He says sometimes, not all times, but sometimes it would be so self-negating that even like, you know, like meaning say it's almost like going back to a Adam Eve state of like, you know, where the clothes are even just a hindrance of receptacle. I mean to say, like, we're so lowly, we're so involved in this world that they can't be anything. So now again, we don't see this in the rest of Tanakh. Meaning to say, we don't hear people making a spectacle of these things. We don't hear anything about this. But the Radak is showing you to the degree in which it could be experienced, which might explain the words that he falls down. When it describes him falling down, it says that. One second. There's the words also describe it a little bit of embarrassment. I can't find it right now. That there might have been an embarrassment as Shaul HaMelech fell down because maybe he was, in fact, maybe he did fully unclothed. The last comment, and I think this is with this will end, and this is the words of the Al Sheikh. What a remarkable insight! What a remarkable insight! He says like this. You know, we have arguments in our lives. We have disagreements. If we're human, we certainly have disagreements, and there's people we can't get along with, and life gets complicated. And the longer we live, the more complicated it seems to get sometimes. So what happens is Shaul is deep in the mud right now. He has got a lot going on in his life. Sometimes a person needs to come back to, well, you know, unpack all that complexity, unpack all those arguments, sort of shed all the exteriors, shed everything which is self-contrived, and the complications we have in life. What's happening over here is Shaul's coming back to a moment where he could go back to his Talmud-like state. He could go back to the state of where he was just an innocent boy looking for the donkeys one day back then. And there was no complexity, and there wasn't the hate, and there wasn't the rejection, and there wasn't the self-fear. There wasn't all of this. And he can shed his clothes, he can shed his big day malchus, he can take off all the baggage which has led him to this point. And this is one moment where he and David can be sitting next to Shmuel HaNavi, and they're both saying, you know, when we're looking at God, there's no complexity, there's no problems, there's no dispute. That's what's happening, says the Al-Shekhov. Yeah, there's this moment of communion which allows them to see to that moment. I think we can all wish for that moment. Like we wish we could get to that moment where we could reverse all those moments in life which we wish we could take back. This is where Shaul HaMelech is at this moment. That's where he takes off his clothes. He takes off all that baggage of all he aspires and thinks he is worth, I mean, in comparison to David. And this closes with, now we can appreciate finally the words of David himself. We say this all of the month of Elul. Take a look at these last words. Bikrov olai melech mereim, says David. Le'echolos besari tzarei va'ayvayli. Heim akosher v'nafari. He says, my enemies are coming to get me. They're going to fall. Right? If a camp comes against me, they send soldiers three times. My heart's not going to be filled. In tokum olai milchoma bezosani vatech. What do I trust in? She'achas shalti me'es Hashem osavakeh. Shifti ve'es Hashem koi me'chayah. You know what I want? God, I want to be in your house. I don't need physical protection. I want to come back to that place where we can all come back to that spiritual point where, you know, where the protection is. We realize that we're all trying to get towards you, oh God. And then if we're all sitting there, we can sit next to each other and we can remember the times and what we're really here for, not all the complexity which created all the enemies and created all the barriers outside the door. That's what David HaMelech was asking for in David HaShem Ori. This moment in his life, what a moment. Anyways, ladies, thank you very much, and we will continue next week.